So if you could tell me your name.
I'm John Cassano, and I am an assistant professor at the University of Colorado, and I study polar weather and climate.
And what are you doing here in Antarctica?
I'm currently in Antarctica working on two projects, actually. One is working with weather forecasters over at McMurdo Weather. I work on developing the computer models that they use for forecasting the weather, and so I'm here to see how the model is working for them, what types of new products we can develop to help them improve their forecasts. The other project that I'm working on is the Antarctic Automatic Weather Station project, which is based out of the University of Wisconsin, and I'm a co-principal investigator on that project as well.
How long has that Automatic Weather Station project been in existence?
It started at the University of Wisconsin in the early 1980s.
Uh-huh. And how many stations are there?
It's something close to 70 around the continent right now.
Oh, right. And why did that start?
In the early days, there was, two motivations for the project. One was sort of an operational weather motivation that in order to forecast the weather well, you need to know what the current conditions are. Mm-hmm. And there are very few observation sites around the Antarctic prior to installation of these automatic weather stations. And so forecasters would have observations from McMurdo Station and South Pole and maybe a couple of field camps, and it really isn't enough to give you a complete picture of what the atmospheric state is. So you have a hard time making a good forecast. Mm-hmm. And so there was that motivation to put in weather stations around on the Ross Ice Shelf near McMurdo Station to give the forecasters a bit better sense of what the local weather was so that when they made a forecast, they had a bit more confidence in it. The other aspect to it was the Antarctic is one of the biggest data voids in terms of weather data. And so putting observations there sort of helps fill that data void. And for the global weather forecast models, they need to know what's happening in the global atmosphere to initialize them correctly. Mm. And so having a data void in the Antarctic impacts even global weather forecasts. So,
does as a modeler, does weather in the Antarctic have a big effect on global weather, or is it mostly a local thing? I mean, I've been reading this alone. I've been reading Bird's book alone, and he says that the Antarctic or the poles is where weather is made.
Right.
You know, he wrote that, I guess, in 1938. And I'm wondering if that's still true or.
You know,
or people think that, yeah, still.
It depends on sort of the scale that you're thinking about. Mm. You know, if I'm forecasting weather in Colorado, the current conditions in Antarctica doesn't make a difference for a 2-day forecast for me.
Okay.
But on longer time scales, that's important. The atmosphere communicates across wide distances over, you know, week to month time scales. And so if you're making a longer forecast, you really need good data further and further afield from where you're interested in making your forecast. Probably for forecasting Colorado, I don't really care about what's happening in the Antarctic, but for the southern continents, Australia, New Zealand, South America, South Africa, that will have an impact on their sort of week duration weather forecasts.
But it's really not especially important the way maybe Bird thought it was. I mean, Australia is just as important as the Antarctic, or there's nothing really super special about Antarctica as a weather maker?
No, I think there is. If you look at how global climate works, the reason that we have storms and weather systems is that the atmosphere is trying to balance the difference between heat loss from the polar regions and heat gain in the tropics. And so those storms ultimately are taking heat from the tropics and moving it to the polar regions, taking cold air from the polar regions and bringing it to the tropics. And that mixing, that exchange of heat, is driven by the temperature gradient between the tropics and the poles. And so, you know, you need both halves of that. And that's really what drives the weather we have in the mid-latitude. So in that sense, that it certainly is a reasonable statement that he made, that you know, the poles are where these weather systems are born.
Wow.
So
how does that happen? I mean, why are weather systems born in the pole? Just because of the unique geography, or
it's mostly that they're just the poles are just the other half of that temperature gradient.
Okay.
And that temperature gradient is what drives all of the atmospheric circulation. And so if you change the polar regions, if like in the Arctic you start to melt sea ice and you get warmer conditions there, you've changed the pole to equator temperature gradient, and you change the intensity of the atmospheric circulation, you change the intensity and character of storms.
Oh.
And so
have you been seeing, since you've been monitoring the weather here, and I know you've been doing some stuff in the Arctic too, have you been seeing a lot of changes? Or
in the Antarctic, over most of the Antarctic continent, we haven't seen a lot of changes.
Mm-hmm.
The exception to that is around the Antarctic Peninsula, where there's been massive warming, there's been loss of ice shelves, things like that. In the Arctic, the warming that we've seen in the last several decades has been pronounced. There was a similar period of warming in the Arctic in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
and then cooled down, and it's warmed up again. And so there's some concern that the warming there is part of a multi-decadal cycle, not an indication of global warming. But the character of the warming that's taking place now is a bit different than what happened in the 30s, which makes scientists think that this is actually part of global warming. It's not part of a longer cycle.
What's different about the character? That it's just more extreme?
It's more intense, and the warming in the 30s was very localized in just the Arctic, and there wasn't much of a signal in the northern mid latitudes. The warming that we've seen over the last couple of decades has been largest in the Arctic, but has occurred over a much broader region of the northern hemisphere.
Hmm.
And so it has a different spatial character.
So in terms of understanding weather in Antarctica, is do you feel that enough through these automatic weather stations and also the weather observers, do you feel that there's enough information there at this point that's coming in as far as what's happening? I say this because I was talking to Michael Carmody at the pole, and he was saying, oh, we need more.
Yes. Well, I don't think you'll ever come across a scientist that says we have enough data,
right?
And we don't need to make more measurements. And certainly that's the case in the Antarctic, I think, in terms of atmospheric observations. The weather stations are great, but they only measure conditions at the surface of the Earth. And the atmosphere is three-dimensional. And you need to know the three-dimensional structure of the atmosphere if you're going to forecast the weather, if you're going to understand what the atmosphere is doing. And we get information in the vertical from weather balloons that get launched, but they're only launched from manned stations. And so we really do have a very incomplete picture of the three-dimensional state of the Antarctic atmosphere.
Hmm.
So I think it's still a large data void.
Is there any way to get sounding data from without there being a person? Really?
Yes.
Oh.
So there are a number of different methods that you can get profiles of temperature and moisture from satellite observations.
Okay.
The problem with that is that a lot of the methods for retrieving those profiles from satellite data work well in the tropics and the mid-latitudes and run into difficulties over the ice-covered Antarctic continent. A lot of them, to work well, they need to distinguish between when they're looking through clear skies and cloudy skies, and a lot of the techniques for distinguishing that are based on having a bright cloud and dark ground. And here, of course, we have bright clouds and bright ground, and so that separation of clear and cloudy pixels in the satellite view is not an easy task. It makes it hard to retrieve the soundings well.
Mm. And what is it exactly that's been your research in terms of developing these models? What's your sort of focus?
The work that I do in the Antarctic sort of been along a couple of tracks. As a graduate student, I got involved with the Automatic Weather Station Project, and I was looking at katabatic winds in the Antarctic. So these are the strong winds that drain off the interior of the continent and down to the slope. As a master's student, I was looking at them with observational data from the automatic weather stations. And in doing my research, I became frustrated that we had, you know, a handful of points of observations and just at the surface, and you could draw some conclusions about what was happening, but you had this big void. You had to guess what else was going on. One of the members of my master's thesis committee suggested that I should think about working with computer models. And if you're using a computer model that's producing a reasonable representation at the points where you do have observations, then you might have some confidence to say, well, I'm going to use the model data where I don't have observations to sort of fill in the gaps and give me a sense of the three-dimensional structure of the atmosphere that I don't get from the observation. And so that's how I started working on computer models. And I moved from the University of Wisconsin to the University of Wyoming for my PhD. Worked with a professor there, Tom Parrish, who actually was a Wisconsin graduate as well. He got his PhD there. And he was involved in computer modeling in the Antarctic. He had written one of the first atmospheric models for the Antarctic to simulate katabatic winds. And so I worked with Tom using his model, and then using MM5, which was a community-developed model that was provided by NCAR. And so that's how I got started on that. When I finished my PhD at Wyoming, I did a postdoc at Ohio State University, and there I worked on development of a polar version of MM5. The work that I did as a PhD student with MM5, I found that MM5 didn't do a very good job simulating the Antarctic atmospheric state. It had a problem. It simulated too much cloud cover. It didn't simulate the radiative cooling of the surface adequately, and as a result, it didn't simulate realistic-looking katabatic winds. So there are a lot of sort of basic problems with the model, and I worked on finding the source of those problems in the model and fixing them. The model had been developed for mid-latitude use, and so it wasn't surprising that it didn't work well in the polar regions. There are enough differences in terms of what processes are important in a polar region compared to the mid-latitudes that MM5 didn't have that right balance.
Now, from what I understand about the models, there's kind of like a grid that you can go over the entire Earth, and then there are different resolutions that the grid can take. So when you talk about developing a polar version of the MM5, does that mean that MM5 is sort of like one grouping of formulas, and then your work would be added onto that, and so it would come into play for the entire global model, or would it be something that's used very specifically for the poles?
There's sort of two classes of atmospheric models. There are global models, which their grid covers the entire globe. And then there are regional models like MM5, where the grid covers just a small part of the planet. And to use those models, you need to specify what's happening on the lateral edges of your domain, and that usually comes from observations or from a global model. And then you can, say, if you're interested in just the Antarctic, running a regional model like MM5 just over the Antarctic saves you a lot of computational time, because I don't need to do calculations over all of my grid points over the entire planet. And it allows me to use a model that has been developed specifically for the region of interest. So I can make sure that the model is representing all of the key polar processes I need, and I don't need to worry about things that aren't important there that might be important in the mid-latitudes or the tropics. And so that's the advantage of a regional model, is that you can tailor it to where you want to work.
So when you work on these models, do you does working on the model give you kind of new insights into the way weather works, or does it go the opposite direction, like you have an idea and then you implement it in a model?
It goes both ways, actually. Initial, sort of when you're first working with the model, the direction of information flow is that you have weather observations, you've run a simulation with your model, and you're comparing what your model has done compared to the observations to see what the model does well, what it doesn't simulate well, where its shortcomings are. And a lot of times you'll use not just the standard meteorological observations, temperature and winds and pressure, but you'll also care about things that help you get at the processes that are acting. So we might have measurements of the turbulent transfer of heat and moisture between the atmosphere and the surface, or the radiative transfer that comes through the atmosphere and comes down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And in looking at those types of process-based observations, you can get at what processes are not well represented in your model. And so you're really trying to make sure the model has the right processes. And if you do that, you then hope that it gives you a good simulation of the atmospheric state, the temperature and the winds and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, that usually works well, that if you make sure the processes are well represented, you then get a good simulation.
So it's kind of like a feedback loop where you're saying, well, this simulation isn't right, and so my processes must not be.
Yep.
Oh, cool.
And then, once you have a model that you're comfortable with and that you feel is working well, then you can run experiments with that model. You can start to look at what that model is simulating in places where you don't have observations. And then it will provide guidance to say, you know, this is an interesting location where I should be making some observations. And so then you sort of are going the opposite direction. You're using the model to direct what types of observations you want to make and where you want to make those observations.
Oh, which is kind of what you're doing here.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yep.
So, what was I going to ask? So a lot of people, I think, that are not in the sciences, mm-hmm. are getting confused about all this talk about simulation models of weather because mm-hmm. because of the uncertainty and you know, we all know about these kind of political issues that have come into play. What do you think is the thing that people are having the most difficulty understanding, or what's the thing that you wish that people really understood about the science of weather models?
I think there are a few things that when I talk to the general public or teach introductory classes to non-science majors, things that I see that are misconceptions. One is sort of lumping weather forecasting and climate prediction together. And they're related problems, but they also are different. For weather prediction, it's very important to know the initial state of the atmosphere, and you need a good estimate of that initial state to make a good forecast. And the atmosphere is the physical laws that govern the way the atmosphere works are chaotic, in that a small change in the initial conditions can at future times lead to a large change in what you're predicting is going to happen.
Mm.
And because we never know the exact state of the atmosphere, we're not making measurements at every point. Our measurements have errors in them. Our forecasts are always being, the computer models are always being started with a non-exact initial state, which means that at some future time, that forecast isn't going to be right because those small differences from reality will grow into a big difference.
Sure.
And so that limits how long we can make an accurate weather forecast. So you don't typically see weather forecasts made out more than about 10 days. That's the limit of predictability that's imposed with the level of observations we have and imposed by the physical laws that govern how the atmosphere works.
Mm. But hasn't it been getting better?
It has. And that's the improvements in weather forecasting have come from two things. One, better observations. So the addition of more and more satellite data that fills in sort of the data voids and gives us a better three-dimensional picture of the atmospheric state. And the second is through research, where we better understand the processes that are acting in the atmosphere and then can include those processes in our computer models so we can make a better forecast.
But you're saying that's going to be exhausted at some point, I've heard this from a meteorologist, at some point it's just going to be the most observations
yes.
possible, but you still are limited.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we'll never get to the point where someone is making an accurate forecast 2 months into the future.
Oh.
It's beyond the limit of predictability for forecasting day-to-day weather variations.
Huh. How do you know that?
There's a lot of early work that was done when computer models were being developed to predict the atmospheric state that looked at, sort of theoretically, at the physical equations that are being used, and the growth of the errors in those equations over time with uncertain initial conditions and with sort of round-off error and all the little errors that get introduced grow at such a rate that beyond about 2 weeks, you've just lost almost all of the signal that you're getting out. And they're simulating reasonable day-to-day variation of the weather, but it just isn't the variation that you'd necessarily observe. So mm-hmm. you'll still have storms coming through, cold fronts and warm fronts and all of those things, but the timing and the intensity and the position of those things will no longer match reality after time.
Okay, so if it's going to be impossible to predict weather more than 2 weeks or so, mm-hmm. then what are these climate people doing trying to tell us what's going to happen in the next 10 years?
Okay, so this is one of the big misconceptions when mm-hmm. I talk to my freshman students. Mm-hmm. The example I like to give is, it's December back in Colorado now, and I can tell my students with a lot of confidence that come June, the temperature is going to be in the 90s again. I can't tell them what the weather is going to be on any particular day, but I can tell them, mm-hmm. I know it's going to be in the 90s in June, and it's going to get cold again in December. And mm-hmm. so there are sort of longer timescale features of the atmosphere that we can predict quite accurately mm-hmm. into the future. Sort of the mean state. We know it gets warm in the summer, it gets cold in the winter. We have a sense of what the transition season, spring and fall, are like. And so that's what the climate models are really relying on. They're making predictions of this longer term state of the atmosphere. And they're not telling you on any particular day that we're going to have this big storm or it's going to be 100 degrees, but they're giving you a representation of a reasonable evolution of weather events that average together give you a good picture of the climate.
Mm-hmm. Like a trend or something.
Right. And so that's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
And those climate models are forced with basically to run a climate model. It's a global model. And so the only things you need to tell it is how much sunlight comes into the top of the atmosphere, and you tell it the composition of the atmosphere. So for the future predictions, we change the composition of the atmosphere with increased greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane and all of those things. Mm. And with that as input, those models will then predict how the atmosphere and the entire climate system will respond to the annual cycle of solar radiation coming in. And so in changing the greenhouse gases, we change the radiative transfer in the atmosphere, we change the amount of heating and cooling that takes place, we change the character of the pole to equator temperature gradient, we change the character of the storms that take place. And so that's what those models are predicting. And those are all things that are well constrained by our knowledge of how the atmosphere and how the climate system works. And so it's sort of a separate problem from forecasting the weather. I want to know sort of the average state of weather at some future time, middle of the 21st century, the end of the 21st century. And those are things that we can predict, but we can't predict the day-to-day weather.
So I'm sure you've heard this question a million times. As someone who's so familiar with these models, what level of confidence do you have in what's the IPCC is saying mm-hmm. about global warming and things like that? And what does that really mean to you as a scientist? Is this like kind of an unprecedented event that's really allows you to learn a lot more about mm-hmm. what's happening? And
I think our confidence in the climate model projections for the next 100 years has really increased a lot in the time that I've been studying atmospheric science, about 20 years. And that increased confidence has come from a lot of different avenues. One is just basic research into the atmospheric processes that are important, and taking that research and applying it to develop more complete and more physically realistic climate models. And so our climate models now take into account not just the physical laws that govern the atmosphere, but include how the ocean responds, how sea ice changes, how the land surface responds. And so we're including all of the important interactions that determine what the climate is at a particular place or a particular time. So that's one thing. Our models have improved a lot. They produce a very realistic simulations of the current climate. And so the thinking is that if we can simulate the current climate well, we can simulate future climate well also. You know, if we have some estimate of how the composition of the atmosphere is changing, how greenhouse gases are changing, we expect that the models will give you a reasonable estimate of what the climate system will look like with those new conditions. The other thing that I think gives us a lot of confidence is that there are climate modeling centers around the world that all have their own models that have been developed more or less independently. And so we have a lot of different computer models that represent the climate system. Mm. And when you have 20 models that are all giving you the same type of results, they're indicating the same types of things, it increases your confidence a lot that the results you're seeing from any one model is not just a fluke, that there's this consistency. Mm. And weather forecasters do the same thing. Forecasting in the United States, there are probably 4 or 5 weather forecast models that are used, and a forecaster will look at those models, and if they're all telling him the same thing,
right,
he has a lot more confidence in his forecast. Well, that's what's happening with the climate models, that they're all starting to point in the same direction, and they're all telling us about the same things, and so that increases our confidence, and we can say, well, here's the range of what the climate models tell us. They're all telling us the globe is going to be warmer at the end of the 21st century than at the start of the 21st century.
Mm.
And here's the range of numbers. And that range is starting to narrow down as well. So I think we're really sort of focusing in and getting a nice
mm-hmm.
estimate of what's happening.
And what do you think about this? I mean, do you think that it's going to be possible to, I mean, is it a major problem? Is it possible to reverse it, just based on your understanding of this stuff?
There are going to be people and places that benefit from climate change, and there are people and places that will not benefit from climate change.
Mm.
The things that concern me, the loss of sea ice in the Arctic, which changes the Arctic physical environment, a lot of changes, the animals that can live there, and it puts a lot of environments at risk for massive change.
Mm.
I'm concerned about melting of glaciers and ice sheets and the rise in sea level that comes from that. I think particularly Greenland has shown some rather large changes just in the last 5 or 10 years, with increased flow of the ice sheet into the ocean, greater calving rates. And those are things that we don't have a good handle on yet, that we can't model the dynamics of ice sheet flow very well.
Mm.
And so we're sort of going into a bit of an unknown with that. And we don't know, as the climate warms, how the ice sheet is going to respond and if it's going to all of a sudden rapidly disintegrate and give you a big rise in sea level.
Mm.
So the IPCC report that came out was criticized as being too conservative in that they didn't take into account things like changing ice sheet dynamics and increased sea level, because they didn't have confidence in those projections. And I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But at the same point, the numbers they gave for sea level rise then are probably on the low end. And a lot of population lives in places that are impacted by rising sea level.
Mm.
So that has global reach, and it has a lot of social implications. So that's something that concerns me.
And I mean, is it something that can be engineered away now that we understand so much and we have such high confidence on these models and everything? I mean, is it a...
I mean, there are people that are proposing engineering solutions.
Yeah, Paul Crutzen's thing.
And the scale of that is, I think, bigger than most people realize. It's a large task to change the entire global atmosphere. And of course we've already done, because we're changing the composition of the atmosphere. But at the same point, I think there are enough places where there can be surprises, that you poke the atmosphere in one way to get a response, and it responds the way you hope, but something else happens as well.
Mm.
And so personally, I don't think an engineering solution is a particularly appealing one, because
mm-hmm.
you're opening yourself up to a lot of potential unknown consequences, and Yeah. I just think you know, morally, that's a dangerous thing to do.
I talked to this IPCC author, this guy Andreas Fischlin, and he was saying that he thought Crutzen was proposing it as just the absolute desperation situation.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem is that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere a long time.
Yeah.
You know, we've already bought into some level of climate change as a result of the changed composition of the atmosphere. And, you know, we're not moving very quickly to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we're emitting. And so we're not only bought into the amount of climate change that we're getting from the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, but we're also accepting some larger change with the increases that are continuing to happen.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm not quite sure how we'll respond as a society to this.
Yeah. Yeah, Andreas said it's if humanity deals with it, it'll be the greatest cultural achievement in the world, which is pretty, I mean, it would be great.
Yes. No, I think it would be. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, the reality of it is that the wealthy nations will be better equipped to deal with it because they can modify their infrastructure to deal with hotter summers or longer lasting droughts or rising sea levels, and poorer nations will bear the brunt of climate change.
Yeah.
And of course they're the ones that are least responsible for it because they're the ones that have contributed the least to the carbon dioxide load in the atmosphere at this point.
Right.
So there are a lot of...
It's a large ethical question.
It is.
Yeah.
So...
Well, let me switch gears here and then talk to you about, ask you about the human weather observers. I understand that you have, and I guess this is true, that you've gone and done storm chasing. And so that seems to be kind of putting yourself at risk a little bit. Why would you do it when you could look at a model or a satellite picture? Why would you take that kind of chance? What is it about being in... physically in the presence of weather?
I mean, I've been storm chasing since I was a graduate student. I actually took a storm chasing class at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, wow, I didn't know they had that.
And I think a lot of people that study the weather and work with the weather do it because they've had an interest their whole life. Everyone experiences the weather. Everyone sort of knows something about the weather. And for some people, seeing the weather and experiencing the weather is something that appeals to us. As a scientist, you know, I wanted to be an atmospheric scientist so I could not only experience the weather but understand why it was happening. You know, when I go outside and we're getting strong winds or really cold temperatures, it's appealing to me to be able to think about what has gone on to give this state of the atmosphere.
Does it help you to think about it, to actually be in it?
Yes.
Oh,
without
really?
A doubt. I think experiencing the weather that you're trying to study provides you with sort of you're more fully immersed in what's happening, and it provides you with a lot of clues and a lot of bits to think about that you miss from just having a weather observation that tells you the temperature is this and the wind speed is this. And if you're standing outside and you feel the gustiness of the wind, or you see the way the clouds are moving across the sky, they're intangible things that are providing you clues to what may be going on. And so the work that I do is mostly computer modeling, and as computer modelers we never need to go outside, we never need to, to be away from our computers, and I work hard to make sure that all of my students get into the field and that they go to the places where they're trying to run their computer models and to simulate, because being on the ground and seeing what a place is like and seeing what the weather is like there gives you an intangible sense of the location, and it improves your interpretation and your understanding of what your computer model is telling you or what the weather data that you're seeing is telling you. So I think it's an important thing to experience that.
Can you give me maybe an example, maybe this is too hard, I don't know, an example of how you experience something and the real world in weather, and then how you went back to the computer and, like, maybe something specific?
I suppose, I mean, one of the things that I get out of being in the field that sort of a direct benefit to me as a computer modeler, particularly with the weather station project, is that I'll go out into the field to these weather station locations, and seeing where that weather station is, you sort of get a sense of what those measurements mean. So there's a weather station up in Terra Nova Bay, sits up on a rocky island, and it's the features around there are at a smaller scale than our models would resolve. And so in seeing that, I know that my computer simulations will never fully capture what is being observed there, because I'm not resolving all of the details of, you know, the small rocky island and the position of that weather station relative to the geography of the area. And so I think it gives you that sense that you sort of have a sense of how much you expect what you model to actually match what's being observed, because what you're modeling is something that's different than what's being observed in reality. So.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. That's like really gets down to the crux of what I've been trying to do with going to these stations.
Yep.
You know, it's funny because you don't, like you're saying, it's this intangible thing. Let me just ask about then weather observers, because there's a lot of weather observers stationed all around Antarctica. Mm-hmm. What are the weather observers observing that the automatic weather stations can't?
The big thing I think the observers get that the automatic weather stations don't is information about clouds and about precipitation. And those are two quantities that are difficult to measure remotely, and particularly measure remotely and without a lot of power available.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing. So we have something like 70 weather stations from the group at Wisconsin around the Antarctic continent, but they don't tell us anything about precipitation, they don't tell us anything about cloud cover. And those are two important properties of the atmosphere.
But one thing it does, I mean, it's got this laser or whatever that points up to see how low the clouds are, right? Or
the
LTER ones have something
yes,
like that.
Yes, the Wisconsin weather stations do.
Okay. But even that, it's just one point.
Right. Although a lot of the observations, even in the U.S., have switched from human observers to automated weather stations.
Uh-huh.
And they do have automated precipitation measurement and automated cloud cover measurements, and they have the vertical pointing lasers, the solometer that measures the height to cloud base.
Hmm.
And
so potentially you don't need human eyes out there.
No. But there's, I mean, things always go wrong.
Hmm.
You know, you get problems, your rain gauge has become blocked with blowing snow, or you know, all kinds of things can happen that a human observer going out day in and day out and making measurements would see, and an unmanned, untended weather station sitting out there, I mean, you have no idea. And
mm-hmm.
you might get clues, you know, in looking at the data that something has gone wrong, but
mm-hmm.
I think there's a real value to human observers. With that said, human observers introduce, you know, you sort of get a bias in that every personal look at some state of the atmosphere, and it's a little bit different to them. They might report a slightly different cloud cover estimate, a slightly different cloud base, and so there's this inconsistency between the observations that a purely automated observation doesn't have. You know what accuracy your instruments have. And
the AWS project is putting this data out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? That'll be, I think, probably my last question,
okay.
Unless there's something more you want.
I think mostly the data is put out for other scientists to use, and there are scientists around the world that use the data that comes out of the University of Wisconsin Automatic Weather Station project. But at the same point, it's on the web, and you know, anyone can download that data. And I think there are people that, you know, they're interested in the Antarctic, and they hunt around on the web, look for weather data, and they find this data, and they can look at it and they can get a sense of what this place is like. And I think, I mean, I'm biased as a scientist, but I think people like that sense of exploring and looking and seeing what they can find. And you know, I think kids in school use the data for projects, and it just gives you a sense that you've done something on your own by taking this data and analyzing it and coming up with a picture of what's happening, rather than just having it fed to you. Someone hands you a plot and says, here's the temperature at McMurdo Station, as opposed to finding the data and plotting it yourself and looking at it. And so I think that's...
So anything else that you would like to say or clarify before we cut, or something you feel like I missed?
I think the we've been talking about weather forecasting and sort of limits on predictability, and the story I like to tell related to forecasting in the Antarctic. I started coming to Antarctica in 1994, and in talking to the forecasters at that time, they said that they were confident in making a weather forecast out for about 8 hours. And that's a pretty short forecast window.
Wow.
And the problem at that point was a lack of observations, and the computer models just, they weren't developed for use in polar regions, so they weren't a very useful tool for the weather forecasters. And this had some real implications operationally, because at that time, most of the flights to the continent were on C-130s, which had about an 8-hour flight time from Christchurch to McMurdo Station. And so you're right at the end of when a forecaster is confident with their forecast. And so there were a lot of flights that would come down, and the C-130s had something like a 10-hour flight range. And so they get about halfway down, and they would get to what's called the point of safe return, where they needed to make a decision if they were continuing on to the Antarctic, at which point they would have to land there, or turn back and go to New Zealand. And so they would get to that point of safe return, and the forecast would say, well, you know, the forecast has changed, things aren't looking that good, and have to go back. And that costs a lot of money, a lot of wasted time. And over the years, with better, more weather observations on the ground, better satellite observations, improvements to the computer models, the forecasters now talk about having confidence in their forecast 5 days out into the future. And that's a massive improvement, and that's something, you know, 13 years. So it's something that I'm excited that I've been working with, and you know, have been involved with, both in terms of the observations and in terms of the model development. I think it's a really nice example of how basic research and basic science can have a broader benefit, and it's helping everyone that's working in the U.S. Antarctic program. It keeps people safer, that there are better forecasts, there's less money wasted on flights that take off from New Zealand and have to turn around halfway, because we don't have a lot of those boomerang flights anymore. So it really is a satisfying as a scientist to see that what you're doing has a real world benefit. So
cool. Okay, I'll just stop.